Okay. We're going to
continue our discussion of building self-confidence.
Even though on your program it says we're going to discuss that this week and marriage and the family next week, Tom and I, hopefully with everyone's approval, decided we'd spend 4 days on this and 6 days on that. So tomorrow we'll start with marriage and the family. But I wanted to take just a few minutes and at least for my own benefit, and maybe for yours, make sure we kind of organize these 4 days into at least the three or four key points that we've been trying to make. And when you have rotating teachers, the benefit is obviously the teenagers get their own time together, their own time to make comments, and I think they are somewhat hesitant to do that up here. And that's good, but when you have rotating teachers, sometimes it's a little difficult, or we have to take extra effort to make sure we keep it coordinated. I believe Monday, Tom spoke to you about a variety of things, but primarily trying to emphasize who we are and what our identity is. Yesterday, he spoke to the class primarily about faith and how our faith in God is the cornerstone of our confidence that we have of ourselves rather than the confidence that we have in ourselves. Tuesday, I spoke with you about the concept of encouragement, specifically about encouraging others or being encouraged by others as an aspect of building self-confidence. And today I'd like to spend a little bit of time about God's encouraging of us. Because it seems that not only are we to encourage one another, but God has set various things in place to encourage us. You could make the point that numbers 3 and 4 are really overlapping, because probably when he gives us one another to encourage each other, that's a form of him doing it, because he set up the ecclesia, he set up the family of God, and he knew that we needed encouragement, and he knew that we needed reminding. I'm going to begin with a couple of scriptures. James, the second chapter, will be the first one, and then we can very quickly flip over to 1 John after we're done with that one. James, the second chapter, verses 15 and 16. There is what I believe to be a commandment for those that are in the family of God. It's not an option, it's a commandment. It's not a suggestion, it's simply something that we're to do. If a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, and if one of you say unto them, depart in peace, be ye warmed and filled, notwithstanding you give them not those things which are needful to the body, what doth it profit? If a brother or sister is in need, if a brother and sister is hurting, we have a commandment to do what we can to alleviate that hurt. Healing is a lonely process. And despite the encouragement we can give one another when it's all said and done, healing is a process that I believe takes place within the spirit of the individual, somewhat alone with his God. You might say you are an island when you hurt. And despite the bolstering up of people around you, sometimes there are those lonely moments when it's only you and it's only God, and you have to work it out as best you can. In 1 John, the 3rd chapter, in the 17th verse, it gives us a similar admonition to what we find in James. But whoso hath this world's good, and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? In other words, if you have the resources to help a brother or a sister that's hurting, and choose not to use those resources, whether they be food, raiment, or material things.
But I think in our day and age, they're more often not the physical things with which people are hurting, but they are the spiritual things and they are the emotional things. A lack of self-confidence appears to have absolutely nothing to do with your intelligence or your IQ. There have been studies that have been done that, in fact, people with higher IQs often suffer from the lack of confidence more than those with the lower IQ. You can question, you can discuss the validity of IQ testing, you can quibble and you can discuss what it is actually measuring, but I think we would all agree that those that we sometimes look at, they appear to be the most secure, they appear to be the most assured, they appear to be the most talented, are also often the least secure. And self-confidence, or the lack thereof, is not something which simply besets the Christian world, or the non-Christian world. It's also something that besets the Christian world. Before we leave point number three, I'd like to get into a list of what I consider to be a few practical points about how to encourage one another. This list could go on, and we may have time to open it up and get some of your inputs, because I believe exchanging ideas on how to encourage one another can sometimes jog our memories, jog our understanding, and therefore, like Lee was talking about, be that piece of paper in our pocket that helps us to remember to do it. There's no one here that doesn't want to encourage their brothers and sisters, but there are very few here that are probably very, very good at it because of the hustle and bustle of life. One way that I think you can encourage someone that needs it is through correspondence. She's not here, but I'll give my wife an A+ on this one. She has sent more cards and thank you notes to people in the 20 years of our marriage than I can remember. I have become infinitely adept at people coming up and thanking me for a card they got and not showing outwardly my utter dismay that we sent them one. She is extremely adept at encouraging people who need to be encouraged. A thank you note, I'm thinking of you card. You sisters can do a tremendous, tremendous amount of good. And let this not simply be for the sick. She finds, and if I can quote her, that when she sends a thinking of you card or a birthday card to someone between the ages of 18 and 25, she gets more response of appreciation from that age group than any age group. That's an age group that falls between the cracks. They're not yet fully mature adults, the heads of full families, but they're no longer kids that we have birthday parties for. And they need to be thought of, and they need to be encouraged. Phone calls. The great thing about encouraging one another is we can all do it. To pick up the phone and dial an elderly person's home and hear them say, "It just thrills my soul that you thought I was important enough to take a few moments out of your busy schedule to communicate with me." The acknowledging of a job well done, not the overly dwelling on the job poorly done. Even though, under the mutual ministry system, we sometimes do sacrifice, you might say, quality in polish, we gain many other things, but I think in general we do an excellent job. Seldom can you sit in the assembly and not be edified. Seldom can you sit in a class and not be exhorted. Tell people about that. But maybe most importantly, simply be a friend. People that lack self-confidence often feel that they lack friends. They tend to be introverted. They tend to feel their value is not worthy of anyone's friendship, and they need the friends the most. But they're also oftentimes not going to be the kind of people that reach out and envelop you in warm arms of friendship. They're the kind of people that you're going to have to reach out and envelop them in warm arms of fellowship. There were multiple reasons that Christ seemed to be most comfortable among those that were weary, trodden. Those that weren't at the peak of their games all the time, but one of the reasons I believe was the concept of friendship. In Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 9 through 12, a passage that we always use in connection, often use in connection with wedding ceremonies, says that two are better than one, for they shall have great labor, great reward for their labor. But I believe that passage is not simply talking about a man and a wife relationship. I think it's talking about two individuals being friends and how much easier it is to carry the load when you've got someone there to talk to. People that have fits of low self-esteem or lack of self-confidence, and that includes all of us, need to have those friendships in place so that then when we need to tie into those friends, we've got them. It's very difficult to develop those friendships after the lack of confidence is already set in. It's great to have those friendships to go to. Few of us, when we walk down the aisle and said, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God," and expressed the desire to be baptized, really knew what was in store for us. Few of us at that moment knew what impact Christ was going to have on our lives. Few of you knew that to a great extent your world would revolve around Christ and the friends that you have garnered through Christ. But that's simply a fact, and you know it, and the smiles on your faces as I make that comment acknowledge that. The confidence that we receive from Him and the confidence we receive from those that are around us. When God spoke in Genesis, "It's not good for man to be alone," I do believe He was discussing the concept of a man and a woman, but I believe He was also discussing the concept of friendship. "For it is not good for us to be alone," because we simply can't survive. Who can bear the weight of Christianity and not occasionally be trodden down into the dust? I believe the answer is none. And despite our desire to be rugged individualists in the tradition of John Wayne and Davy Crockett, the fact is we're not built to go it alone, we're built to go it together. God knew it. Let us also know it. The look on a young child's face the first day at a new school. He looks around, or she looks around with great trepidation, saying, "Will there be a friend here for me?" The pensive fear that envelops the spirit of that young child until someone comes up and says, "Do you want to play?" That's friendship. That's encouragement. And that's the beginning of confidence for that young child in a new setting. When someone says, "Will you be my friend?" and that lonely search is finally over. Most of us are better at having numerous acquaintances than we are at having close friends. But a plethora of acquaintances does not take the place of a few friends. Seek them out, because they will give you confidence. James Taylor, when I was growing up, had a song that was so popular, and it was sung over and over again. It was entitled, "Need a Friend." "You just call out my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running to see you again. Winter, spring, summer, or fall, all you've got to do is call, and I'll be right there. You've got a friend." Yes, we sing what a friend we have in Jesus, but let us also understand what a friend we have in one another. It's God's destiny for His people to soar like eagles. He refers to this in Exodus chapter 19, verse 4. He also refers to this in Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 31. God has a destiny for each one of us, and in order for us to fulfill that destiny, we've got to build our self-confidence. The lack of confidence is not cured by a sermon, but by a smile. It's not alleviated by a pounding, but by a pat. And that's something we all have to remember. I'm getting ready now to move into point four, so I'm going to pause here for just a minute, because I had a lot of comments after Tuesday's session that I wish I could have written them all down before I forgot them. But a couple of them that I did remember, and then I'm going to see if you have any that you'd like to add to it, this concept of encouraging one another. One lady made a comment to me that we have to understand that encouraging one another takes different forms, because people respond to different forms of encouragement, and what encourages one may not be the exact same thing that encourages another. Somewhat like raising children as we encourage one another. What works for one child isn't always the automatic thing that works for the other. And another comment was made, and we'll probably talk quite a bit about this next week if we have time, is the concept of when you're selecting a marriage partner, look amongst the characteristics and see if you can see an encourager in that individual that you seek to marry. Because there's been many a mate that's been turned into a teacher, been turned into a public servant, been turned into an evangelizer, not an evangelist, but an evangelizer. by the encouragement of a mate. One that holds you up. One that pats you on the back rather than pounding you in the ground. And I also believe, one comment before I open it up, that self-confidence is different between men and women. Because I believe as men begin to grow and out of teenage, they begin to value intelligence in themselves and they strive to build up their intelligence. And to some extent, the world system does reward a man for being intelligent. Women, equally intelligent and many times more so, sometimes look upon their self-confidence in the eyes of beauty. Therefore, they will extol and try to be beautiful. I don't fault the women for this. It may be that they know us men better than we know ourselves and know that men can see far better than they can think. Therefore, they extol beauty rather than intelligence. But I do believe there are differences between the sexes and differences between the ages as to how we develop our self-confidence, and we have to be attentive to that. Let me pause and see if there's anyone that has a comment that is germane to this or might have been left over from any of the sessions Tom and I have had on this before I move into kind of a new section here. Mike?
My wife's grandmother passed away this last year, 96 years old. And everyone called her Grandma Oxley. And even those who were not related at all to her, everybody called her Grandma Oxley. She chose in her life to have herself to define herself in terms of those about her. She was Grandma Oxley to everyone. She was anybody's grandma, even old people's grandma. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we choose to define ourselves in much different terms that perhaps aren't nearly as important. We define ourselves based on our occupation or based on our income or other things that really don't make much difference.
That's a good comment, and I'm fighting the urge to get into some of the material I hope to cover with you next week. And some of you have heard me say this, but as people get old, there is that role reversal. Old people need grandparents also, but sometimes their grandparent is now younger than they are. But you can still fulfill that need, and it's a beautiful relationship when you see that occurring. Dan?
The area of building self-confidence and being an encourager is, I think, one of those important traits that we're supposed to have, but it's a tricky one, as you've already mentioned. For two reasons. One, if someone is struggling with self-confidence, one of the things that we can do to decrease their self-confidence is to hammer them about how great they are, because they're already struggling with how great they're not. And so we have to be patient and gentle along that line. I've seen more people destroyed by good-intentioned people because they were wanting to build up. We just have to be a little patient.
Sure.
And that's the other thing that the other end of that then is as we encourage people, know that it's going to take time. I can remember a particular person that I worked 6 months to gain their trust, to talk to them. And it just took that long of gentle encouragement before we could even begin a discussion. So we have to give ourselves time and be careful about trying to fix it all at one fell swoop.
Absolutely. And you do have to be sincere. People just read through that so quickly. So quickly. Assume everyone else can see insincerity as well as you can, and you'll probably be close to right. It absolutely destroys. I'll just take a second. There was a story I was reading the other day about a businessman who was on an airplane, and he opened up the little dinner there to eat it, and two roaches fell out of his dinner. He was irate. He sent a letter to the president of the airline company and just raked him over the coals. He got this letter back and said, "You're absolutely right. The stewardess is on probation. We've stripped the airplane of all of its equipment. We're debugging it, and thank you for bringing that to our attention. Secretary sent it back, had made the mistake of attaching his original complaint letter to it, and across the bottom he had written, "Send him the standard roach letter." just lost its whole impact because of the insincerity of that. You just can't do that. You can't have the same comments. You can't have a contrivance about it because it comes through and does ultimate damage. Anybody else got a comment? Keith, Eric?
I want to address this situation of striving for intelligence. As I'm struggling to come out of adolescence, and it's a long, hard battle, and I'm still in it, but...
So am I.
Yeah. you find that you have to latch on to something. I mean, the desire is there to latch on to something and do that one thing well. And in 2 Peter chapter 1, it's a passage that we turn to many times, and we see what I'd like to refer to as a cycle for building your Christian character and, if you will, your self-confidence. Add to your faith moral excellence, knowledge, to knowledge, self-control, to that perseverance, godliness, brotherly kindness, and love. And many times I find myself, I get stuck on this knowledge thing where I don't worry necessarily about the wisdom that I'm deriving. But anytime we find ourselves stuck on one of those things, and I have gotten stuck on other things as well, I suffer and my self-confidence suffers as a result because I'm not a well-rounded individual. And I believe that's why Peter wrote this, is that if we become well-rounded and we strive for that and not necessarily just try and find our niche with knowledge or be a self-control freak, then we can achieve a better self-confidence.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the great problems of finding confidence in intellect or beauty is that those are relative terms, and confidence comes in those two if you are the most intelligent amongst those you're around or you feel you're the prettiest. Well, then there's always going to be someone come along that's more intelligent or more beautiful, and if your confidence is attached to something that has a relativity to it rather than something that has an absoluteness to it like God, you're just an accident waiting to happen, and you see that time and time again. Good comment. Anybody else? Okay, let me list a few things. I'm not going to deal in great detail with this one for obvious reasons. We're spending about 5 hours on it this week. But one of the areas in which I believe God encourages us is through the Holy Spirit. And He does that in a couple of interesting ways. But let me share with you a couple of words that I think really put this into perspective for me. Those are two Greek words, and I'm not a Greek scholar any more than some of you are, but I suspect you're somewhat familiar with at least one of those. The bottom one that I put up here, and you can put different endings on this, is the Greek word that's translated comforter. You find that in John chapter 14, 15, and 16, and there it refers to the Holy Spirit. Rick alluded to the concept of the comforter. This word... And you don't have to be a Greek scholar to understand those are very similar words. That's the word that's translated exhort, as in Hebrews chapter 10, where it says to exhort or encourage one another. It seems to me that when we're encouraged by God, it's very similar to when we are encouraged one another. And when we're encouraging one another, we're probably doing as close to the work of the Holy Spirit here on this earth that we are humanly capable of doing. And I don't mean by that statement to say we're coming anywhere close to doing one for another what the Holy Spirit does for it. We're simply coming as close as we can come, because they both mean to comfort and to encourage. God has called us alongside His Spirit, and that is a tremendous confidence booster for those who will allow His Spirit to work in them. In John chapters 13 through the end of that book, you recall the disciples were called together, and Jesus was in essence giving them encouragement and some teaching and some understanding in the last few moments of his time with them in the flesh. These were men that were going to be decimated in many aspects by his disappearance, by his leaving, by his death, and that concept. And he chose to give them the assurance that a comforter was coming. He chose to give them repeatedly in John chapter 14, verses 16, 18, and 26, in John 15, 26, in John 16 and 7, and the beat goes on. Time won't allow us to turn to all of those. But he expresses it as the comforter that he's giving them. That which helps us, in my estimations, build the confidence that it takes to be a Christian. Let's turn to Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, not because you're unfamiliar with it. But there it bespeaks of us being transformed by the renewing of our minds, being changed, being given the mind, or set on the process of being given the mind of Christ. It's this transformation, this begetting us into a position of confidence. When we come up out of that watery grave, and Dan talked a little bit Tuesday night, I guess, about burying the old man. When we do away with the old man and we take on the new man, that's a change. That's a confidence. That's the washing away of the things that keep us, that should be a washing away of many of the things that keep us from being confident as we should. Psalms 118, verses 8 and 9 tell us that confidence comes from the Lord. Ezekiel 28 and 26, confidence knowing that I, the Lord, am their God. Isaiah 30 and 15 talks about having quietness and confidence. Those two concepts seem to go hand in hand because it's the quiet that's a self-assured. It's a quiet that knows who he is. This mental metamorphosis, if you will, that lets you know you're God's person. If we could just appreciate what God knows we can be through him, I think it would be very, very difficult for many of us to have our fits of lack of confidence. The concept of prayer. When one learns how to truly communicate his most inner feelings and worries to the Lord, it endues confidence. Philippians chapter 4, I'm going to just read a couple of verses there. But it tells us there about our anxiety, our anxiousness. And I think anxiety and anxiousness often comes from a concern about confidence. But in verse 6, he says, "Be careful for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be known unto God. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Jesus Christ." In Matthew chapter 6, he tells people, when you pray, don't be hypocritical and don't harbor ill will, two great destroyers of self-confidence, because when you're a hypocrite, you know it. If you want to hear a beautiful prayer, listen to a new Christian pray. Listen to a young child pray. I was doing a couple of VBSs last month, and we decided to each day let as many of the young children pray publicly as wanted to. And sometimes I'd get one, and sometimes I'd get four. And you didn't know what was going to come out of their mouth, but it was a daytime VBS, so I thought it was pretty safe. Some of the most beautiful thoughts came out of these innocent, pure minds that had not yet all of the cliches and all of the phrases placed in it. The outpouring of their heart in just such a few short, sincere words. And I thought, oh, if I could only go back and pray like that. And I don't know why I can't. Maybe I can, and I just have to keep working on it. But the beauty of a new babe's prayer. He mentions also the concept of supplication, which I'll put in kind of as 3A. But the asking, the need-centered petition, asking the Lord to help us, to let our requests be known. If we fail to turn it over to the Lord, then there's no way he can turn our weakness into strength. I believe the Lord strengthens our confidence by giving us the Word. My mind went back to the first psalm where he says, "In my law doth I meditate day and night." This total absorption. We've had several times this week, we've gone to the book of Revelations, and we sometimes look at that as the most confusing and difficult book to understand. I'm not sure that it is the most confusing book, but it's up there in terms of difficulty and understand. You know why Revelations was written? It wasn't to confuse us. It wasn't to have the last laugh by giving us a book at the end of the Bible that we didn't think we could ever understand. It was written to encourage the saints. It was written to tell the saints, you're going to have trouble, you're going to have persecution, but God's going to win out in the end. The passages Jim looked at with us in Revelations 20, we're talking about God winning out in the end. It was a book of encouragement from the Lord. To have our minds immersed in His Word and to have His words immersed in our mind is a confidence builder for all of us.
Well, I don't know if you can see, but I'll tell you what this says.
And I want to spend just a little time on it, and that's the concept of forgiveness. I found it interesting this morning that there were lots of questions, lots of discussions about forgiveness, how people should or shouldn't come forward, what they should or shouldn't say. But I'm firmly convinced that God is a far greater forgiver than we are. And many times He has forgiven us of things we yet struggle to forgive ourselves of. Many times we turn it over to the Lord and He forgives us, and yet it just continues to whirl and whirl in our minds and eat and gnaw at our very insides. And the tragedy of that eating and gnawing is that maybe it's a lack of faith, maybe it's a lack of understanding, but it's a tremendous efficiency killer for a Christian. Because no one can be at their best of the game, the most effective for the Lord, when they haven't forgiven themselves. In 1 John chapter 1 and verse 9, it says, "If we confess our sins, He is faithful to forgive us and to cleanse us." And the word cleanse there is katharizin. It's the same word that we get the word now catheter from. And anyone that's ever been exposed or involved with a catheter knows that it just continually keeps cleansing and cleansing and cleansing. God will has forgiven us. And that's a message I think we need to take back to our home congregations, to those that are new in the Lord, to those that just continue in self-flagellation. Yes, we have to repent. Yes, we have to change. Yes, we have to confess. But if we believe anything in this book, He will forgive. I don't mean this to be cruel, there is absolutely no excuse for a Christian questioning whether God has forgiven him if he's repented and asked for forgiveness and followed the things that the Bible tells us. I'm impressed in Psalms 51. That's the Psalms that seems to have been written by David after his sin of killing the husband and with Bathsheba. But he says, in effect, in verses starting about verse 10 and 12, that he was willing to forgive himself, and he even goes to the point of saying, "Lord, now take me, cleansed and forgiven, and make me a converter of the sinners. Make me effective again. Give me the confidence to do that which I have to do." I fully appreciate that it's hard to understand and hard to accept how God could forgive some of the messes we get ourselves in. But it's simply a fact that He will. And that He can. Probably one of the reasons we don't forgive ourselves as well as we should is we've simply disappointed ourselves, and no one likes to disappoint themselves. Why did I do that? I knew better than that. How could I be so stupid? Well, I don't know how you could be. You just were. Or I was. But that's the forgiveness of the Lord. You never can get away from the consequences of sin. They linger. But you can get away from the pollution and from the guilt of sin. David didn't get away from the consequences of his sin. He got away from the spiritual pollution of his sin. the referral in 1 Corinthians to the sexual immorality that we find in chapter 5, and then we go over to the second book of Corinthians in chapter 2, and Paul there tells the congregation, enough is enough, lest this man be swallowed up in overmuch sorrow. This man apparently had repented, and enough was enough. He'd been forgiven. Let him then go on. When we self-flagellate ourselves, we not only injure ourselves spiritually, which is the most tragic, but we also injure ourselves physically. Many, many of the ailments that beset the world and beset some of us are due to our inability to know that God has truly forgiven us and relieving ourselves of that guilt. Why should we think less of ourselves than God does? And he says we're his children. We're his sons. Why should we think we're harder to forgive than God thinks we are? Does low confidence or lack of confidence draw you nearer to God or keep you further from God? Does it make you more effective as a worker or does it make you less effective of a worker? As a worker, does God want you to feel good about the creature he's turned you into or not? Okay, I'm going to pause again, not because I'm at the end of my page, but just to give you a chance to make a few comments or ask a few questions if you would like to, because I want to make sure we have time for that. Bev?
John, what about the person that says, well, I can forgive you, but I don't know if I can forget?
Well, I'll give you my opinion, then I'll have a little discussion on that. I might say that, because I think sometimes it is hard to forget, and I'm not sure we're always necessarily supposed to forget, but if that forgetting gets in the way of our forgiving, then it's a problem. I think God can still remember things that I have done that he's forgiven me for. The problem I have with it is many times when people say that, they're really not forgiving, and they're harboring it back in the back of their brain, and then if that person does it again, then they say, well, that's two, that's three, and I guess they feel they're going to go up to 489 before they get to that 70 times 7. But I don't know how to blot things out of my brain sometimes, and when I tell myself to forget something, it makes it harder to forget, because that's become an event. You know, if I said, everybody forget I wore a red tie, you're going to remember. If I had said that, you would have not even known. Would anyone like to comment? Keith, is that on this?
Yeah.
Eric.
That's all right.
No,
Dad.
It's not.
In not forgetting a wrong that has been done, sometimes it's beneficial in that you might be able to prevent providing a temptation or a possibility where your brother or sister might stumble. If you are mindful, again, if you're wronged, it's a blatant. We talked about confessing faults. The fault comes out, mm-hmm. and the sin comes out, mm-hmm. and there's no confessing to it. It's there. And if you don't forget that, there might be occasions in the future that you might be able to use that information to both of your benefits.
Sure. And even if you don't mentally forget, I think you can act like you forgot. By that I mean there's no place for rehashing that with other people. There's no place for continuing to let that go. If you can forget, that's great. I just question whether we can always totally mentally forget. Dan? Oh, I'm sorry. Where are we at? Mike?
Along those lines, let's say, for example, you and I were in a business venture together as Christian brothers, but also in business. And let's say, for example, I end up really swindling you and take you for all you're worth. And then finally the matter's cleared up. I've gone to you. I've said, you know, this is wrong. Please forgive me, and you say you forgive me, and then a little while later, I come to you and say, you know, John, I think we should get in business together again. Now, there's going to be a trust. There's also an issue of trust here. Should you trust me to do this, even though we've forgiven and all that's been taken care of?
Of course. And I could have been comfortably in this whole page of notes right now. I want to say no, but I also want to have a good solid foundation for that. I think I should have forgiven you for any wrongs, but I believe if I have identified in you a lack of a talent to execute a certain thing, then I should be able to learn from that assessment. Let me phrase this in another way. If you were a doctor and you operated on me and you botched the operation and came to me and said, "I'm sorry," I should forgive you, but I don't necessarily equate that with having you do the second operation on me. It's important that we forgive, but I believe there's an area of learning there that can still help our conduct without being a lack of forgiveness. It's almost as tied as this concept of self-confidence. Dan, and then Jim.
Okay, and the whole idea of forgiveness, that was where I wasn't going, but forgiveness is really making a way back to an original relationship, because that's what Jesus does. That's what Jesus has done for us. When we ask for forgiveness of God for our sins, what Jesus' blood does for us is puts us back in that relationship. Mm-hmm. God trusts us again, just like He had done before 14,000 times. We're supposed to forgive as God forgives. I think there is inherent in that issue of forgiveness a sense of rebuilding that trust between two people. And that means we take a risk. It's a calculated risk. We might say to our friend, "You know, we've had this problem before. How about if, yes, we will go into business, but I need for this time for you to, let's put some money away. Let's work something out here as a trust factor. Somehow I've got to work back into that relationship. It doesn't happen quickly." Anyway, but let me go back to the idea of forgetting, just real quick.
Okay.
We can't forget. Our brain records every piece of information that ever happens to us our entire life. It records something like 1,600 bits of information per second as we're sitting here. The light conditions, everything. If we look at the Apostle Paul, who had a lot to forget, you know, he had stood at the feet of people as they were killed because they were Christians.
Mm-hmm.
This is a man that could be taken over by remorse. His secret was in Philippians, the third chapter, is forgetting what is behind, and this is how you do that. How do you forget? You strain toward what is ahead. You press on to the goal to win the prize for which God has called me. Okay. And that's how we forget. We can't get rid of it, but we refocus and push on to something that's more worthwhile. Remembering the past doesn't help us in the sense of, unless we use it to build positive like Paul did.
And definitely dwelling on it doesn't. Definitely dwelling on it. We'll go to Jim, then I've... Okay, Marvin. Thank you for keeping me straight, Stan. Or Steve.
We were taught in teaching children not to to quit stuttering, that a difference to be a difference must make a difference. And I think that applies in forgiving someone. If I forgave you and treat you as though it had never happened, it didn't make any difference what you did, then I've accomplished what God had in mind. I think that's the way God does us.
Okay. Go ahead, Jim.
When we restore someone in the spirit of meekness, we also consider ourselves, lest we also be tempted. In other words, it is the memory of that sin that causes us to be careful.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I was also thinking, as I had a little time to reflect, it appeared that in Paul's relationship with Mark, there was eventually a restoring of that relationship. But Paul didn't forget, or he would have taken him on the second journey with him. There was a period in which Mark had to reestablish, and maybe, if you'll allow me to use the word, earn that confidence back. We don't like to use the word earn when it comes with Christianity, but there is, love is freely given, but respect is earned, in my opinion. And I believe there was not a forgetting there, but he was able to eventually restore him. Anybody else? I'm not going to get to my other page, so we've got 2 or 3 minutes here. Margaret?
God loved Moses so much, but Moses done something that God never forgave him because he asked the second time. So what are your comments on that?
Say it again.
He wanted to go into the promised land, you know.
Okay.
And he made one. Of course, God had loved him so, and he'd done so much, you know, and all.
Okay.
But he made one mistake, and somehow God never forgave him for that.
I would say God didn't forget.